Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Canada is Pennsylvania's largest international trading partner. In 2018, Pennsylvania exported about $10.8 billion worth of goods to Canada. And now there is a new international trade deal on the table, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement that replaces the North American Free Trade Agreement. To talk more about Pennsylvania's relationship with Canada and the new agreement is the Consul General of Canada in New York, Phyllis Yaffe. Consul General Yaffe, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. We were just talking before we went on the air, so I have to kind of relate this conversation to our audience. I ask how long you had been in Harrisburg. You've been here for the past 2 days, right?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
And, okay, so you did a lot, met with the Pennsylvania Chamber, legislators, but one of the first things you mentioned to me was that you had a Pennsylvania Farm Show milkshake, right?
I certainly did, and it will be a memory I keep with me for a long time.
You know, I'm not in a position to work out trade agreements, but what do you think about Pennsylvania Farm Show milkshakes going to Canada?
I think it's a great idea.
You know, you could go back to Ottawa and make that. Okay, just
small business opportunity.
There you go. Very good. Very good. But on a more serious note, the last time we spoke last year, in fact, I was reminded it was June of last year that we spoke. Tensions between the United States, there were some tensions between the United States and Canada, especially between President Trump and your Prime Minister Trudeau, about trade between the United States and Canada. Since then, a new agreement has been worked out, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement to replace NAFTA. Not a whole lot of changes, but there are some here and there. When I say not a whole lot of changes, I mean we're talking millions of dollars in some cases. The Trump administration has touted this agreement as a good deal for the U.S. How is it viewed in Canada?
It's viewed as a real step forward. It's viewed as an important trade relationship, the most important trade relationship we have, and it solidifies the rules of the road so that we can continue to have free trade between Canada, the United States, and Mexico. It is absolutely crucial to the economy of Canada, but also, I think, to the economy of the U.S.
Before we even move forward, I think I have to ask about how NAFTA was viewed in Canada. Donald Trump, when he campaigned for president, said it was a bad deal and that it was one of the promises that he made that it would be renegotiated so that it would be better for American workers and the U.S. How was NAFTA viewed in Canada?
You know, it was free trade with America was a very divisive idea early on in the 80s when we just had a free trade agreement with the U.S. and there was an election fought over it. It became a rallying cry on both sides. But over time, I think Canadians agreed that it became sort of the standard for a simple way for us to do the commerce we had always been doing without the tariffs that would limit our ability to sell both to the United States and to Mexico. It certainly never had the stigma that the president attached to it in Canada.
There were a lot of Americans, maybe people who didn't even support Donald Trump, who said that it needed modernizing. And I've noticed language that even Canada has used in referring to the agreement as modernizing this trade agreement that was over 20 years old.
Yeah, it certainly needed modernizing. We were happy to do that. You know, the reality is it had been amended 11 times over its life, so we knew that it could be improved. There were places where it certainly needed to be improved. Our ambassador always says that when the agreement was written, Amazon was just a river. So we didn't have a digital commerce chapter. We didn't appreciate the role of the environment in business. There were many things that needed to be improved, and most of those I think have certainly been improved, if not made perfect. And, you know, we argue that the perfect is the enemy of the good, and I think we certainly made this a better agreement.
Mm. We'll talk more specifically about some of the parts of the new agreement in just a few minutes, but I want to talk about Canada's relationship relationship with Pennsylvania. The trade agreements were trade between a whole nation like Canada and individual states. Doesn't get as much attention as what international trade between two nations gets. But Pennsylvania, as I said in the introduction, $10.8 billion worth of goods exported to Canada in 2018. I would have to think that, Canada is Pennsylvania's biggest trading partner. And you're here every year. And why do you come to Pennsylvania?
Pennsylvania is a very important state in our remit. I mean, my particular consulate general is in New York City, but we're responsible for Pennsylvania, Connecticut, New Jersey, Delaware, and of course New York State. But Pennsylvania is, I said last night to some of our guests at our reception, that it really is a microcosm of the United States. It has very significant cities with particular issues and particular political persuasions, and it has the countryside where you really see what America is made up of, and small towns, smaller towns, cities that reflect a diversity of American views. And so I think Pennsylvania is a hugely reflective part of the United States, and we believe that our trade with you is absolutely crucial both to some of our big provinces, but really as a nation. We understand the role that Pennsylvania trade plays in the overall perspective of our business relationships. We like to remind people when we come every year, we're your best customer.
And of the top 10 products that are exported from Pennsylvania to Canada, number one is chemicals. Mm. And I was just curious, and probably a lot of Pennsylvanians don't know this, but what kind of chemicals are we talking about? Did I catch you off guard with that one?
Well, you know, we trade in chemicals, in oil and gas, in aluminum and steel. But, you know, the top Pennsylvania goods exports to Canada are plastic and plastic articles, as far as I'm concerned, in this year. But, you know, medical and precision instruments, and of course, iron and steel tubes, pipes and sheets, and of course, and you know, on that front, in the iron and steel aluminum sections, those issues were the heart of the matter when I came last year.
That's right.
That was of great concern to Canadians because there was a tariff imposed on our steel and aluminum, and obviously Pennsylvania being a manufacturer of those commodities, but of a type of steel and aluminum. We believed, and I think we have been proved to be right, that those tariffs were harming both the manufacturing side here in the United States and, of course, in Canada and Mexico. So we are we're delighted to see that the tariffs are gone. I can't think of other tariffs that have been removed lately. So I think what happened in that case is we really saw a concerted effort with particularly Pennsylvania manufacturers, Pennsylvania businesses, the government, state governments and the federal government, and of course, individuals, farmers, everyone else who put their hand up and said, if this is keeping us from finding a way through to a trade deal, it is wrong and it is harming the economies on all sides. So the relief we feel over the removal of those tariffs is gigantic. And I think we are back on a better road today than I was a year ago.
Let's talk about that year. And I mean, we've just discussed already some of the changes that have been made. I can tell, just an observation, that you're much more relaxed than you were a year ago, because it was a pretty tense time between the United States and Canada. I mean, do you actually feel that we are on, the two nations are on a better path right now?
You know, the answer is yes. I came to speak to the legislature last year. And I think for the very first time in my career, and I'm sure in the legislator's career, a Canadian came to address the legislature and had to be very blunt about the difficulties we were facing. And I think, you know, I give lots of speeches about the relationship between Canada and the United States and how strong it is. But that moment was very difficult. And I think people in the legislatures were taken aback that Canada would say bluntly, as I did, that this was an unacceptable path. I mean, I think it's important for everyone to realize that the foundation of those tariffs was an item 232 in the books of American tariff processes. And it was based on the fact that Canada was a national threat, a national security threat to the United States. So as much as we obviously dispute the fact, it was more important to think about what that meant to the heart and soul of Canadians who feel that we have been and continue to be allies of America in war after war after war. Today is the anniversary, 75th anniversary of D-Day. I think we share that Memorial Day. Our Prime Minister is standing beside the Queen, as is the President. And it is so important to us to know that the relationship we have with the United States is based on trust and security and support, and that the families that cross the borders, and there are so many of them, are really still families. And so I think we have reversed that concern, and I think that is why I feel very much more relaxed this visit than I did last.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on Smart Talk over the next few days, books to read on vacation this summer. We'll be talking about family leave legislation and forest management in Pennsylvania over the next couple weeks. We invite you to share your questions in advance by sending us a voice memo or leaving voicemail. See what's coming up at WITF.org/smarttalk. On today's program, our guest is the Consul General of Canada in New York, Phyllis Yaffe. We're talking about the relationship between the United States and Canada, and specifically about Pennsylvania and Canada. Canada is Pennsylvania's largest trading partner. If you have a question about this relationship, about trade, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalk@witf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Mrs. Yaffe, when I look down through the list of the top 10 exports from Pennsylvania to Canada, I see only one that is agriculture related, and that is processed foods. It's a bit of a surprise because dairy products and trade of dairy products was really one of the big sticking points or the points of contention when we talked about trade. So let me talk a little bit about that. Agriculture, as I said, one of the areas that was most evident. Dairy farmers in the U.S. felt that Canada, more than 200% tariffs on American dairy products was way too high. Now, this agreement, the new agreement, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, allows American farmers to sell more milk, cheese, and other dairy products in Canada by increasing quotas. What does that mean?
So, each country looks at their dairy and poultry industries and has to supply both the local market and look at the international market. Canada exports about 1% of the international dairy market. We're really in the supply our own citizens with dairy business across the country. And the way we manage dairy in Canada is a system called supply management. We allow the farmers a quota, and they are allowed to create as much as that quota is and sell it. But after that, there is no market for their product. In the United States, you don't do that. You don't regulate the quantity made, but you have a farm bill that subsidizes farmers. So we've chosen different routes to create and supply dairy to our markets. There are limits on what other foreign countries and producers can sell in Canada because of that supply management. There are quotas. So over the years, we have managed to work out the amount that foreign countries, particularly obviously America, can sell into Canada. It is not a huge amount. We are a small population, about the same size as California. So important to remember that although we are a very large country, the second largest geographic mass in the world, we have the population of California. So the market is a fairly limited one. Nonetheless, in this agreement, we have agreed to expand the amount of dairy products being sold by Americans into our market, and that will change dramatically for some producers their economics, and we've agreed to that. It is, as you can imagine, not so popular with dairy farmers in Canada, but we will find a way to make that acceptable over time. We also got rid of some of the irritants in particular, very small but very important categories that some farmers produce in, and they were excluded from, and now they'll be able to sell. But I think it's important to know that although it's a huge industry here in the United States, and particularly in Pennsylvania, there are more dairy cows in Wisconsin than we have in our country. So your population being as gigantic as it is, 10 times ours, the market is a pretty limited market. So expanding it at the cost of Canadian farmers to our own market is not an easy thing for our country to do. It comes with a political cost, but it was considered to be an acceptable cost to create the entire new agreement for free trade between our three countries, and we were willing to do that.
The figures that I saw coming from the U.S. said that this could increase the sale of dairy products in Canada by $70 million. Now, that's million. And, it doesn't sound like a lot in the total, but it is $70 million. One thing I know we discussed last year, and I'm curious about it this year, one of the challenges that American dairy farmers are facing is that there are fewer Americans drinking milk using dairy products. Now, cheeses, that's a little bit different, some other dairy products, but drinking milk and some of those. Is it the same in Canada?
Mm-hmm. It sure is. Liquefied milk struggles to really retain its sort of universal view of health and wellness and, you know, important part of a healthy diet. I tell the story of I was in Stockholm for a vacation, and I was sitting in a cafe with very small little place, and there were some Americans sitting beside me, and they asked the waiter for oat milk. And the waiter said, "Sure, we have oat milk." And I like to point out, it's not milk.
Our farmers will point that out quickly.
Yeah, and, you know, I have no idea what its health characteristics are, but here I am in the middle of a tiny place, and people no longer ask for dairy. So, it is a challenged industry, and it is certainly, it's a universal thing. It is not just a North American thing, but it is important to know that we have to adjust as this change comes to the world. I'm sure it is as alive and well in Canada as it is in the United States and in Stockholm. Mm.
I mentioned those tariffs that in Canada were on some American dairy products above 200%. From what I understand with this deal, that sales above the quotas will still be subject to tariffs from between 200% and 300%. I mean, when Americans hear that, they think, what? 200% to 300%? Explain that if you would.
Well, I think it's simple. There's no market for those products. You know, I think it goes back to the size of the population, the local farmers we're protecting, and of course you do as well, as I said, with the Farm Bill. So what we do is regulate production. Once we have gotten to what we think is the right production for the country, and we allow in foreign production, if it continues to go above the quota, it then actually destroys the market for our local farmers. So I think it may seem like a large amount, but it is placed on a very, very small number of products that come across the border because there is no market beyond what we have. And so if you're asking us to replace Canadian dairy with American dairy, I guess the reverse question is really the important one. How would you feel? Mm-hmm. How would you feel if dairy farmers here were told prices would be undercut, your production would be removed, and Canadian dairy would replace you? Of course you wouldn't want it, nor do we. So it is really to stabilize the market, keep it the size it is, feed the people we have, and remember that you have 10 times the population we do.
This may be too obscure, but I will ask it anyway because it was on the American website. What's with British Columbia and American wine?
Well, American wine is about 25% of all the wine consumed in Canada is American wine. So, again, it is a very substantial exporter of America's a huge exporter of wine to Canada, and we enjoy it. So we want to keep that flow happening. But the local, you know, the local production across the country is growing, both in quantity and certainly in quality, and we're very proud of that. So there is always going to be this push and pull over what. How we support the local industry. British Columbia, the Okanagan Valley, I hope everybody gets a chance to see it, a beautiful part of the world, very much like, has the climate of Napa, very much like the climate of Northern California. And there are two or three other parts of the country that do that as well. And so we protect, again, our market in some ways. But I think it has to, you have to go back to the fact that 25% of all the wine from all over the world, France, Italy, all the great producers of wine, the United States has 25% of our market.
But what was it, British Columbia in particular, and I should provide some context here, that what this agreement would do is eliminate how American wine was treated in British Columbia grocery stores. And as I said, that may be too obscure of a question, but the agreement did say that. And I was just wondering if British Columbia, after hearing what you had to say about that with the 25% import, the British Columbia was somehow different than the other provinces.
But I think it's fair to say that inside the agreement, that irritant has been taken away. So the rules in British Columbia will be equal to the rules everywhere else across the country. You know, we do feel that we have opened our borders to many of the products the United States raised as concerns. But I think we all, you know, the best way to think of this agreement is we all had to take, and this is particularly relevant to this conversation, a little water in our wine in order to make the deal a success. And so British Columbia will open its market more to American wine. But across the board, we've all had to step back and say, how do we come to an agreement that, you know, Vice President Pence was, I was at a meeting with him last week in Ottawa when he came to talk about the deal with our Prime Minister. And I said to him, you know, I quoted you for 2 years because he started the conversation 2 years ago by saying, this has to be a win-win-win agreement. We all have to come away feeling we gave some, but we got some. And I think the reality of the deal is that is the case today with wine, with dairy, with auto parts, you know, which is really a significant part of the agreement. The vast auto manufacturing sector in Canada that supplies the United States, you know, a car sold in the United States is likely to have crossed the border into Canada 7 times before it's manufactured completely. So the best way to think of our relationship is we make things together. We have an integrated supply chain. And when it's working well, we all benefit. And I think the agreement has now helped us get closer to that again.
Quickly, I have an email here from a listener who says, I sell and design equipment for businesses in central PA. Many of the manufacturers I work with are based in Canada. They are good partners to have and provide great products and services. The tariffs applied to goods have done more than increase the cost of my Canadian goods. They've also increased the cost of the products made here in the U.S. The end result appears to be an increased cost to the consumers in the United States. I assume the Canadian feel similar to what was he experiencing.
You know, that is incredibly well said because it explains what a tariff is. It's the consumer who winds up paying the cost. I can't underline how important that concept is enough because the reality is when we impose a tariff on products coming into our country, it means that eventually those costs get passed on to a consumer and vice versa. The money does not go to the government.
Consul General of Canada in New York, Phyllis Yaffe. Thank you very much. Always good to see you. Enjoy our conversations about the two countries, the state of Pennsylvania and Canada. Thank you for being with us today.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Smart Talk
tomorrow,
on WITF.
June 6th,
your home
marks
the 75th anniversary
of D-Day.
I'm Scott Lamar.
The Allied invasion of Europe that eventually led to the defeat of Nazi Germany and the end of World War II. Much is being written and said about the significance of the anniversary, but best-selling author Alex Kershaw has provided a unique perspective in his new book, The First Wave, The D-Day Warriors Who Led the Way to Victory in World War II. Alex Kershaw, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you.
Your book is unique in that it looks at D-Day from the perspective of several of the key military participants, the warriors, as you call them in the title. But they're not named Eisenhower or Churchill. What stories did you set out to tell when writing the book?
Well, I wanted to pick 10 main characters that you could follow who had the toughest jobs, the most important jobs, the guys to land first and fight first, who, if they had failed, then D-Day would have failed. So I wanted to celebrate guys that achieved incredible acts of heroism and made the big difference on D-Day.
Well, the characters that you chose certainly did. Anyone who has heard the story of D-Day knows that it was put off by a day because of bad weather. But what many may not realize is just how worried Eisenhower was about the weather and the mixed feelings that his senior commanders had about a June 6th launch. And you go into detail about June 5th, 1944. Tell us about that day.
Well, Eisenhower finally, around about 4 o'clock in the morning on June the 5th, gave the final order to go ahead. Only he could make that decision, not the king, not Marshall, not Roosevelt in D.C. 53-year-old Allied Supreme Commander Dwight Eisenhower alone was able to make the decision to launch the biggest invasion in history, and he was very, very concerned when he did so because a storm was blowing outside the building where he had his final conference. The rain was literally pelting against the window panes, so it was not the most ominous of moments to launch this invasion across the English Channel. But he was very concerned about whether it would stand a chance of success. Not one senior Allied planner or general was 100% confident. Eisenhower himself was racked with doubts and fears and was very, very nervous indeed. He was smoking 60 filterless cigarettes a day. He had a palsy in his right arm from having to sign so many orders and was extremely stressed. I think it was, if there's one moment in the 20th century when one guy had enormous pressure on his shoulders, I don't think you could pick a more stressful moment than Eisenhower on the 5th of June deciding to launch this critical invasion.
Something else that was unique about your book is that the focus is not just on Americans. Many of the books, if not most of the books, that we read about D-Day and World War II in this country are just focused on American soldiers. Yes, they'll mention Bernard Montgomery and the British forces, but your book goes extensively into British, French, and Canadians who were all part of the invasion. I assume that when you told that story of the main characters and the participants, that that's part of the full story and not just the American point of view.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you have to remember that this was the pinnacle of Allied cooperation. We did this together. Less than half of the soldiers on D-Day were American. The Canadians, 15,000-odd soldiers, were all volunteers. And, you know, of the five beaches, two were American and three were Canadian and British. So it was a joint Allied operation, and it was thankfully successful, but it was one that was carried out by, I think, altogether, there were some 30 nations involved on the Allied side.
But again, getting to hear that perspective or the stories told from the British, the Canadians, and the French, it's almost like there's a whole new audience of Americans learning about those major contributions.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's important to realize that this had been planned by the Allies for a long, long time. And in fact, if you look at the Overlord commanders, these are the guys at the very top. On the morning of the 5th of June, there were seven guys gathered around a table with Eisenhower at the head, and of the seven, only two were American. That was Omar Bradley and Eisenhower. Everybody else was British. So in terms of the top guns, the big guns, it was very much a British-led affair and very much British planning that was involved here. But let's not forget that on the day itself, American, British, and Canadian, and some, a few French lives were on the line. It was the beautiful thing about the D-Day story, it was you can't find a better example of where allies have come together and literally fought shoulder to shoulder and sometimes died together on a very, very important day for world history, which was the beginning of the end of Nazi Europe and the beginning of the liberation of Western Europe.
So let's talk about some of the characters in the book and their contributions, because they all had important roles. And it's just when you sit back and listen to the challenges, the hurdles that these men faced, it's just incredible to think about. I want to start with British Major John Howard and his gliders at Pegasus Bridge. Tell us that story.
Well, can you imagine being at 6,000 feet around midnight on the 6th of June in a wood and canvas glider, being set free, and then with a pilot only armed with a stopwatch and a compass, crash landing at 12:15 a.m. at over 90 miles per hour? The pilot was a guy called Jim Woolworth, and he did an amazing job. He actually crash landed the glider about 30 yards from Pegasus Bridge, which was a very important target for us on D-Day. And within 10 minutes, Major John Howard and his men had seized two bridges and had sent out the first success signal of D-Day, which was the code words ham and jam, ham for one bridge, jam for the other. But, I mean, this was an extraordinary operation. You know, can you just imagine what it's like to be, in the utter darkness, listening to the wind whistle through the canvas of these wings and knowing that you have a very good chance of being killed in a few moments, because you literally are crash landing in a wooden glider. It was extraordinary. There were many cases like that with the glider units in particular. I think that was probably, apart from landing in the first wave on Omaha Beach, I think being in a glider on D-Day was about as dangerous as you could get.
And I think many of our audience members, our loyal listeners here on Smart Talk, realize or are aware that I was on a station, WITF trip, just a few weeks ago to Normandy and saw Pegasus Bridge and saw where Major Howard and the other gliders landed. What struck me was how small a space this was. I mean, you just described it in total darkness with the enemy only a few yards away, but the amount of space, it was like a football field, and that's it, less than a football field.
Yeah, to land three gliders. And I mean, could you believe how close you were to the bridge when you stood beside the statue to Major Howard? I mean, it's like, what, 30 yards?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and that was called, that act of flying was called the greatest single act of flying of World War II by the head of the Allied Air Forces on D-Day, because when you actually go there, you cannot believe that someone managed to land a pilot managed to land a glider that close to the objective. It's incredible.
Why was Pegasus Bridge significant?
It was at the far eastern end of the Allied bridgehead. It was about 55 miles long, the bridgehead, and we needed to secure the bridge over the Caen Canal and the bridge over the Orne River, because if we didn't control those bridges, when the Germans counterattacked, they could have mopped up Allied forces on that eastern flank pretty quickly. So we needed to hold those bridges to be able to control that eastern flank of the bridgehead. It was a very important objective.
Yeah, when you look at it just standing there and looking at it, you're thinking, this small bridge, how significant could it be just over this small canal? But it was very significant. So moving on to the 101st Airborne and the paratroopers. This is what many people remember besides the beach invasions about D-Day, and often think about the Saint-Mary-Glace and a paratrooper getting stuck in the steeple at the cathedral there. But talk about the role of the paratroopers from the 101st.
Well, the very first American to put his boots on the ground on D-Day was a guy called Captain Frank Lilleyman. And he was a pathfinder. What the pathfinders had to do was they had to drop in first and set up radar sets and very bright lights so that those could guide in the main SkyTrain of C-47s carrying the 101st Airborne. There were around 6,500 paratroopers in the 101st Airborne, and they dropped around 1 o'clock in the morning on D-Day. They began to drop about 1 o'clock in the morning, but you had a very critical job to perform if you were a Pathfinder, because if you didn't set up those radars and those lights, then the SkyTrain wouldn't know where the hell to drop the paratroopers. There were 6 drop zones for the American Airborne divisions on D-Day, and they had to be marked out, otherwise those pilots coming over wouldn't know where the hell to drop these guys. So Lilleyman was the first guy. His boots dropped. He dropped to the ground at 12:15 a.m. And today is officially recognized as the very first American to see combat on D-Day. He was in control of the Pathfinder unit that set the course for those waves and waves of C-47s that dropped all those paratroopers.
As you say in the book, the very first, Captain Frank Lilleyman, first to reach French soil on D-Day. Many of the paratroopers, in fact, almost all of them, did not land where they were supposed to. And it brings up another question, or observation, and then a question, is a lot went wrong on D-Day. But if you would, talk about those paratroopers, those Pathfinders who are landing all over the place. And, you know, it would not seem to be a good way to be successful.
Well, yeah, the whole question of whether Allied airborne operations were that successful in World War II can be debated endlessly, because there's still a lot of people that believe that they were not worth the effort, that we didn't gain that much from those operations. The operation on D-Day was wildly chaotic. A lot of guys were mislanded. Very few people landed where they were actually supposed to be landing. Maxwell Taylor, who was the division commander of the 101st Airborne, said afterwards that never had so many commanded so few. He was in charge of a single private. So you have a division commander with 6,500 guys jumping out of the air, and he's in control of a single private for around about 2 hours, which goes to show you just how far dispersed they were. Some people were 40, 50 miles away from where they were supposed to be landing. It took 48 hours, 2 full days, before the 2 American divisions, the 82nd Airborne and the 101st Airborne, had any real command structure. That meant that, you know, from the top to the bottom, everybody knew what they were supposed to be doing. It was 48 hours after D-Day before anybody could really organize both of those divisions. The most important thing to say about the Allied airborne forces on D-Day is that they were given a job. It was chaotic. There were very high casualties in some units, but they got the job done. They managed to defend and protect the rear of Utah Beach with the 101st and 82nd Airborne. And so you had 30,000 American troops landing on Utah Beach on D-Day who weren't slaughtered, unlike at Omaha Beach. So however chaotic, however problematic, they did actually manage to do the job. And that's what we should remember, that these guys jumped out of these planes. Many were killed. It was an enormously risky operation. But it worked. Thank God it worked.
The 5 beach landings, these men were on landing crafts for a long time, because a lot of this was set up for an invasion on the 5th of June. They were seasick. Once they got to the beaches, they were loaded down with equipment. So you had men that were drowning in the surf. They were wading through deep water while being shot at. There were obstacles on the beaches. Veterans of D-Day have often said that it has been hard to recreate, but in the movie Saving Private Ryan, that may have been the best depiction of arriving on the beach. How would you describe the landings, especially at Omaha Beach, where Americans landed?
Well, I think that the veterans that I've spoken to would all agree with you that from Saving Private Ryan is a pretty good reconstruction. Put it this way, I don't think you're going to get better. But there are a couple of very important things that people don't see in a movie. They don't smell anything, and they don't really hear what was going on, because a couple of veterans I talked to said that landing on Omaha Beach, there was a complete, constant wall of noise. So you could barely hear yourself think. Shouting an order, unless the guy was a yard away, they wouldn't hear you. It was that loud. And there was only guy I could find is an officer alive today, so that's a second lieutenant or above. Only one guy I could find alive today, a guy called John Rahn, who was a 22-year-old captain on D-Day. He landed on Omaha Beach with the Rangers. And he said that it was for about an hour and a half while he struggled through the water and tried to get off across the beach and then up the bluffs. There was a constant popping, like a pop, 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 pop above his head. And that was machine gun bullets firing above his head. So these guys on Omaha Beach, in some places you really literally were in a slaughterhouse. And in some sections, when I've taken people back to the beaches, and you were there recently, I've explained that in some sections there were so many machine gun bullets that bullets literally were falling like rain. I mean, in some sections, maybe 100 yards wide, you'd have thousands of machine gun bullets arriving every minute. So one sector of Omaha Beach, Dog Green Sector, there were eight sectors on Omaha Beach, and Dog Green Sector was Company A of the 116th Infantry Regiment. Out of 180 guys in the first wave, we believe that 102 were killed. That's not wounded, that's killed outright. That was the bloodiest sector of Omaha. In fact, the deadliest place you could find yourself on D-Day was that section of Omaha Beach. So yeah, there were sections where it was, you literally were slaughtered. I mean, you were very lucky to be able to even return fire. Very few people got to even fire a shot back at the enemy.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. We're speaking with Alex Kershaw, author of the new book, The First Wave, The D-Day Warriors Who Led the Way to Victory in World War II. Of course, tomorrow being the 75th anniversary of D-Day, and the book is unique, and there's a lot to learn in the book, a very good read. Focusing on some of these characters, Mr. Kershaw, let's talk about a few of them as well. Lieutenant John Spaulding, one of the first off the beaches, and men followed him at Omaha. Talk about, before we even go into that, one of the things that Lieutenant Spaulding said was that no man had a right to survive on Omaha Beach. It was that dangerous.
Yeah, he landed in the second deadliest part of Omaha Beach, which was Easy Red. He was the big red one. That was the only division that came from the sea that had seen combat before, American division. And he arrived at H hour, about 6:30 in the first wave, and managed, after about an hour and a half of absolutely hellish combat, to lead the first platoon that escaped from bloody Omaha. He was the first guy to lead Americans off the beach and up the bluffs. He walked through a minefield. He said that he had an angel on each shoulder because none of his men were killed or wounded by the mines. A few hours later, several of the guys were, but he felt immortal after D-Day. He said that, you know, if he hadn't been killed on Omaha Beach in the first wave on D-Day, then God had a reason for putting him on the earth, and that was to lead men in combat. So the extent of his luck and the miracle that he said that he'd experienced of surviving was profoundly affected him. And guys like that, he was 28 years old. He'd never been in combat before. He'd never led men in combat. So that was his, literally when that ramp came down on the landing craft, that's the first time he'd ever seen real action. And it took guys like that. It took hundreds of guys like that on Omaha Beach to make that a success rather than a complete disaster.
When you describe someone like John Spaulding, you point out in the book, and you actually express some surprise that there weren't more medals handed out as a result of the D-Day invasion. I mean, very few. There were some Distinguished Service Crosses, but just a few, Medal of Honor. Why is that?
That's a great question. I mean, for the Americans, you only had four Medal of Honor recipients for the whole of D-Day. So that's well over 50,000 Americans involved, and you only hand out four Medal of Honors. I mean, one of them was Theodore Roosevelt Jr., the oldest general officer on D-Day, 56 years old, the famous president's son who landed in the first wave at Utah. And the other three were all given to guys in the Big Red One, the 1st Division, on Omaha. So I think there were 153 Americans received the second highest award for bravery, which is the Distinguished Service Cross. But there were several cases where guys should have received the Medal of Honor and their award was downgraded. And I think that was because people thought that somehow if you gave out too many medals, then the significance and the prestige of the Medal of Honor would be somehow diluted. Although if there's any place on the planet in military history, if you're an American where there was more bravery. I can't name one than Omaha Beach on D-Day. I mean, what happened there with, you know, almost countless. I mean, there were so many cases of extreme bravery that it seems sad that only three guys received the highest award.
Point de Hoc, the cliffs overlooking the beaches, and Lieutenant George Kirschner. What can you tell us about George Kirschner?
Kirschner, again, was a, you know, I think people forget that the majority of Americans, the vast majority of Americans seeing combat on D-Day had never been in combat before. So it's a kind of, it's a majority virgin force. And Kirschner was one of those guys. He was a lieutenant in the 2nd Ranger Battalion. That's 225 guys that were given what Omar Bradley described as the toughest job on D-Day, which was to scale the cliffs at a headland called Point de Hoc and seize a battery of guns. So these guys are the, you know, the famous Rangers that had grappling hooks and, you know, fired them from landing craft with rocket-propelled grappling hooks, and then had to climb up ropes, literally 120-foot-high cliffs with Germans dropping grenades on them and firing at them. So it was a very, very tough job indeed. It was successfully carried out, but with very high casualties. Over 60% of those Rangers that landed on D-Day were killed or wounded, more than 70 guys killed from 225, and they were in constant combat for almost 48 hours after they landed on D-Day. So extraordinary heroism, very important objective which was taken, and I think that the Kirschner and his fellow Rangers at Point de Hoc kind of epitomized the guts and the grit that it took to get the job done on D-Day, and were very rightly lauded by President Reagan in 1984 when he went back for the 40th anniversary of D-Day and stood above the cliffs, right above the cliffs, and talked about the immense courage of the boys of Point de Hoc. And some of them really were boys. They were teenagers.
There's 48 hours that you mentioned. I mean, this was not something that was from the when once they got the Rangers got to the top of Point de Hoc that they were saying, okay, we got this one. They were surrounded by Germans throughout those 48 hours. And they thought, many of those soldiers thought, we're done for.
Yeah. And also, you know, the perimeter after when they first arrived, there was a perimeter. And that over 48 hours, that perimeter got, you know, narrower and narrower and narrower. More and more guys were killed. More and more guys were wounded. They were running low on ammunition. It was a very, very, very harrowing period indeed. In fact, Kirschner, the lieutenant I talk about, you know, for him, actually landing on D-Day and climbing the cliffs was pretty straightforward. He said that actually the climbing the cliffs on D-Day was a lot easier than when they'd been in practice with the British commandos. It was quite straightforward. But what wasn't straightforward was fighting off German counterattacks for the next 2 days. And that was very, very harrowing indeed, because the Germans were well-armed. They knew the territory. They knew the ground. They knew every hedgerow. They were heavily disguised, heavily camouflaged. And they knew what they were doing, and they knew how to slit an American's throat very quickly in the middle of the night. So you couldn't even afford to fall asleep for 5 minutes in case you were surprised and killed. So it was a very, very, very draining, exhausting, harrowing experience, which Kirschner never forgot. I mean, he kept a diary after the after D-Day and wrote about those hours of the 7th and 8th of June as being the very worst of his life.
So many stories that are in the book that we won't have an opportunity in our short amount of time today to discuss. But the big question is, why was this invasion successful?
It was successful because we threw a hell of a lot of very brave Canadians, Americans, and British at a heavily fortified shore. We had air superiority, and we had the element of surprise. The Germans knew that we were coming, but they didn't know exactly when and where. So a combination of a lot of different factors, very detailed planning. But really, when it came down to it, on the day itself, I think people tend to forget that what made the difference was we're individuals, guys with guts, guys that stood up and walked into enemy fire and were prepared to give their lives for other people's freedom. It really did come down to, it wasn't about bombers and it wasn't about generals. Really, on the day, D-Day was won by individuals with great, great courage that were prepared to give everything for others.
Alex Kershaw, the author of the new book, The First Wave, The D-Day Warriors Who Led the Way to Victory in World War II. Alex Kershaw, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.